Greetings, Shockers. It's Rob G here, recording this the morning of Wednesday, March 25th. Unfortunately, we learned just last night that Stuart Gordon has passed away. Stuart was one of the masters of horror. He directed so many great films and features and did so much interesting stuff in theater. And myself and the rest of the Shockwaves gang definitely intend to discuss him at great length for our next new episode this Friday. But in the meantime, we wanted to do something a little special. My co-host Elric Kane had reminded me that several years back, we actually had Stuart on Killer POV, our previous podcast, to talk about his entire career, but mostly he was trying to make a feature version of Nevermore, the Edgar Allan Poe play that he did with Jeffrey Combs. So this actually aired October 11th, 2013. On the Geek Nation Network, and it's not really available online anymore, so we thought we would represent it here in honor to the great Stuart Gordon. So here you go. Enjoy.
All right, so we're back. You know what, Elric, because you were so anxious to spoil who the guest was, I'm going to let you do this intro for once.
The director, you wouldn't have heard of any of his movies, so we'll just go to his theater production. Just kidding. He is Reanimator the Musical, most recently Reanimator the Musical. And
caught that one.
Truly one of, and you know, people always will think when we have guests that we're going to be ass-kissing, but genuinely one of the best things I've ever seen in my life live, and something that got me so just like excited about like theater and the crossover of like storytelling, Nevermore, mm-hmm. An Evening with Edgar Allan Poe, is that the full title?
Yes.
Starring Jeffrey Combs, who also starred in our guest's most famous film, I guess, The Reanimator. So welcome, Stuart Gordon.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. So, I mean, I guess we should start with Nevermore.
Yeah.
I guess.
We've all seen it, right?
Yeah. I just moved to LA. I actually saw it. It was one of the first. The thing I love about the show is I saw it, I think, three or maybe four times, because I moved to LA about 4.5 years ago. Wow. And it was like the first week I moved here, you had started the show. And I was a big fan already. We had met briefly because Stuart was in my Psycho documentary, which you watched already. You haven't yet.
I haven't.
So I went to check out the show. And you know, I always appreciated Jeffrey Combs as an actor.
I've had the same conversation.
Know,
this is funny,
but I feel like we get spoiled and forget how good he is because you know then we'll see him on all these television shows and all
Star
that kind
Trek,
of stuff.
He is amazing.
Well, yes,
yeah,
he is
amazing.
Star
kidding?
Trek. But again, that's range. It's most actors aren't given any real range or latitude, right? Once somebody discovers you can do something well, they make Jeffrey. You know, like the Frighteners and Reanimator are a certain type. But
yeah.
I couldn't believe when I walked out of the theater what he had done.
And that's why I felt compelled to go back and see it more than once is because, you know, I mean, I'm always in awe of actors in general. Like I'm friends with quite a few of them. And in particular, AJ, like I'd worked on something with him and he memorized like 10 pages of dialogue in like a day and just did it in all these different ways. And I'm like, wow, that is something that I am incapable of doing. So the first time I saw Nevermore.
That's what makes someone a director, not an actor.
Yeah, thank God for actors. So the first time I saw Nevermore and I just watched Jeffrey pull off that performance. I can't remember. I think it was like maybe 20, 30 minutes into it when he's reciting like The Raven or some poem. I'm like, dear God, he had to memorize all these Poe poems and stories. And he's just, you know, and he's given it his all every night. So to me, I was just like, I was just so fascinated by his performance. And it made me appreciate him as an actor more than I ever did before. And to the point where then I brought more friends. I was like, you guys got to see this show because it's like a one-man show. So yeah, it was fantastic. So that was my experience seeing it.
What drew you to adapting? And you adapted this with Paoli as well?
Yes. Well, we had done an episode for the Masters of Horror,
right,
in which Jeffrey played Poe. It was an adaptation of The Black Cat, and we made Poe the protagonist of the story.
Featuring the same nose, right? He kept the
exactly,
prosthetic
that's
nose.
Right, he did. The same costume
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was so amazing as Poe. I kind of started feeling like I was hanging out with Edgar Allan Poe when we were shooting it. And we started saying, wouldn't it be great to do this live on stage where an audience can be in the same room with Poe. And then we started, you know, researching his recitals and, you know, the ones that he gave towards the end of his life where he would recite The Raven and tell a story. And he usually did them by candlelight, actually. You know, that was how the project came together. And it was for Poe's bicentennial in 2009. that we did the play.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Jeff connected to, and how does he stay connected to do it for such a long period of time? Was it something about the man or his work that you think he?
Well, he's very, you know, drawn to the to Poe, you know, to his work and also his life. I mean, his, you know, when you start reading a biography of Poe, it's like one of his stories. I mean, this poor kid, you know, was orphaned at the age of two, raised by a, you know, foster parents who were very wealthy, and then, you know, ran away and joined the army, and ended up marrying his 13-year-old cousin.
Right.
I mean, it's just all these crazy things. And then, you know, he had such a hard time of it. You know, he had a drinking problem. He kept, you know, he was like his own worst enemy. He would constantly lose his jobs. You know, just a fantastic guy. And then even his own death, he died at the age of 40. Mysteriously, no one knows what happened. He disappeared for several days.
Yeah, I always thought that would have made the most logical if somebody was going to make a film, because it's great because, you know, at least that way no one can counteract what you say about the last week of Poe. But do you have any feelings, like gut feelings from, because you guys probably research more than most people.
There's all these different, you know, theories, but the one that I think is the makes the most sense, because one of the things that's strange about his disappearance was when they found him, he was wearing someone else's clothes,
right?
And he had no identification, and that seemed so bizarre. Mm. And what they think might have happened, they know that there was an election going on in Baltimore, which is where this, you know, he disappeared. And they used to take these guys, drunks, from polling place to polling place and have them vote over and over again as different people and put different clothes on them. And that's what they think may have happened to Poe, that there were these gangs of, you know, these sort of pollsters who kind of took him along and got him, you know, kept feeding him alcohol, and to the point where he ended up dying of alcohol poisoning.
It's a good idea for the tea party. if you're listening, guys, you could use it.
Well, you know, I come from Chicago.
And okay, right. Yeah,
that's a common tactic.
Yeah, it is. Vote often is one of the.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the interesting aspects of even going back to the Black Cat, if I recall correctly, didn't you want to put Jeffrey in your first episode of Masters of Horror, but something happened that he couldn't be in it, so then you brought him on board for Black Cat?
No.
Something like that? I thought he was going to be in the first episode you did.
Dreams of the Witch House?
Dreams of the Witch House.
I thought maybe I read something like that. Like maybe a cameo or something. I don't know.
No, but I, you know, we were talking about Poe, you know, for a long time before this, you know, and then the idea of doing the Black Cat. My daughter is a high school English teacher, and every Halloween I go to her class and talk about Poe.
Hmm.
And one year I read The Black Cat to the class and scared the crap out of them. Mm-hmm. You know,
I'd buy that CD, by the way. You should read The Black Cat.
That story is so disturbing. And I realized reading it to them that it's, you know, it's been made into films a million times, but they've never had the nerve to do it the way Poe wrote it.
Right.
And so that was sort of the beginning. And then the idea, knowing that Jeffrey wanted to play Poe, putting him in as the protagonist, because the character in the story is a drunk who is normally a very nice guy, but when he gets loaded, he, you know, turns into a monster. And that seems a lot like the real Poe himself. It's written in the first person. So we developed it as a, you know, for the Masters of Horror, and that led to Nevermore, you know, the play.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you expect Nevermore to, like, when did you realize that Nevermore was kind of something special? Because I remember it being just for a couple of weekends or something like that, and then you guys extended it, and then you guys ended up doing it for quite a while.
Yeah, originally I think it was a 4-week run is what we announced, and we were sort of crossing our fingers hoping that we'd make it through the 4 weeks, because, you know, the idea of going to see a play where someone is going to be reading poetry, that's not...
it's a tough pitch now.
Yeah, it's a hard sell. Yeah, it really is. But it being Poe, it changes everything.
Well, I mean, the part, the telltale heart when he tells the story. I mean, I think the thing about reading, you know, Lovecraft and Poe, they're totally different, is sometimes they're hard to read now. You know, for people raised in our generation. And when I saw him deliver Telltale Heart, it was so alive.
Yeah.
And just the way he gets into that story, it's like being told. I mean, I've seen all the old Vincent Price staged film stuff that they have him telling these stories, and it's so different when Jeff gets
animated.
Well,
it's funny, you know, last year I was, again, talking to my daughter's class, and they had just read The Telltale Heart, And one of the questions they asked was Poe a serial killer? Which I thought was a fantastic question.
And I guess the answer is maybe. In that last week, maybe the answer.
Well, because he writes about it. So, it sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And, you know, it's so internalized and it's so believable.
Right.
That, you know, at least if he wasn't, he certainly understood.
I'd put money on it that if he hadn't found writing. He found his channel. Thank God. I'm always curious because, okay, so the idea to turn it into a film, which is, you know, that's a whole conversation we want to have here.
How
do you keep the essence of something that, you know, the live essence of something and turn it cinematic?
Yeah.
Because they're so different, those two.
Yeah. Is it still just going to be the one actor?
No, it's not. We are going to open it up. And so when we do the Telltale Heart, we'll actually show it
if
it were, you know, as a movie.
Nice. It's a movie.
So you'll see him, you know, killing the old man and burying him under the floorboard.
Will Jeff be the characters in those sides?
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And he'll do the Raven with a real Raven, you know.
Okay, cool.
And Annabelle Lee and so forth. But we'll also, you know, have him doing the recital in this theater in which his fiancée is sitting there, Sarah Whitman. And, you know, and he keeps drinking a little too heavily. And
keeps calling her out even though she doesn't want to be called out.
And he's promised her that he would stop drinking.
Yeah.
You know, that's what sort of the thing that's the unspoken part of the story. Until she finally walks off and leaves him and their engagement is over.
And he gets drunker. at that point. And sadder. One of the things that I was struck by with the show is how it feels like a whole, not necessarily a whole life distilled, but all the ups and downs of a life, especially Poe's life, in 1 hour and a half, in one speech. You know, he's giving this one lecture because the emotions I felt, you're laughing. By the end, you're like really in like near tears watching this man's life destroyed. It's really an incredible ride.
Well, I've had audiences say they felt like they wanted to do an intervention.
Right. Yeah. that could be the sequel, Celebrity Intervention.
Because you're watching this guy just literally, you know, drinking himself into, you know, sort of madness. And you want him to stop and you like him and you kind of say, you know, don't have another drink. You know, you're already too drunk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what kind of gives the show its edge and its suspense.
And I think that's going to be the key, you know, as a director, right? That will be the thing when you translate this to film, trying to still touch people because it's still an emotional story, right?
Yeah, well, I always, with my films, I mean, coming from the theater, I try to make them as involving for an audience as possible to really put, I think audiences want to be put to work.
Yeah.
And I think so many of the movies that we see now are very passive experiences.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So having something where the audience can kind of get involved. That's what I'm all about.
I particularly found that in the last, was it your last one or second to last? Edmund was a film that I really responded to. I was really surprised by that film. I knew I wasn't familiar with Mamet's play.
Oh, good.
And I remember just like it was a descent into hell that I wasn't prepared for. I mean, honestly, it might have been the best depiction of hell on earth, as they say, and yet funny. Like, you know, by the end, it's actually pretty damn, I mean, William H.
I think it's very funny.
Especially by the end, the last sequence. If anyone hasn't seen that, I'd highly recommend Edmund.
Yeah.
I think not enough people probably saw that film.
No, it's so funny. When I was pitching it to the studios, I would always say it was funny.
Yeah, black comedy.
And they'd go, what's funny about that? And I said, well, you know, I said, can you give us an example of like something that's funny in Edmund? And I said, well, I think it's funny that when they ask him why he murdered this person, he said, I think I just had too much coffee.
That's great. So you have to keep the emotional story. So when he's on stage, will it feel like he's on a, it won't feel, you're not shooting it like he's on a theater by himself with a real audience. It's going to feel like an actual film. Like he's going to feel like he's in.
I mean, the audience will be
in costume.
Costume. Okay. You know, the stage lighting is going to be gaslight. You know, it's going to be set in 1848. Yes. There'll be a stage manager in the wings tearing his hair out, you know, because Poe is like going completely bonkers.
In other words, it won't be cheap. It'll still cost money.
It will, yeah. And Sarah Helen Whitman will be sitting in the audience, you know, looking very uncomfortable and trying to get him to stop drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So whose idea was it to create, like how to get this? I talked to Jeff a long time ago and he was talking about like, well, let's try to find a way to live, you know, shoot this live. And it was very problematic from what I
because didn't you guys film a lot of? I remember going a few times and seeing cameras, and I just assumed it was just for you guys to kind of.
We did shoot a record of the show, And you know, again, shooting theater is very difficult.
Yeah.
Because you really—it's never as good as being there and feeling like you're, you know, experiencing it personally. But we did that as, you know, so just to capture it. And I think our sense was that we need to do more than that if we're going to make a movie of Nevermore. You know, it's really got to capture the period as well.
And whose idea was it to come up with, like, well, right now the idea is Kickstarter, right? So, yes. So obviously films aren't as easy. Well, they've never been easy to get money for a movie, right? But
well, I think they've gotten a little harder.
It does seem like they've gotten a lot harder.
They're really hard. I mean, I read an article recently about what a hard time Spielberg had making Lincoln.
Yeah.
And this is Steven Spielberg,
right.
You know,
yeah.
And, you know, they ended up giving him what for him is a tiny budget, $50 million. He was almost going to do it on HBO is what I had heard.
Yeah, yeah. I read that too.
And, you know, it's you'd think that, you know, that would be, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world to get money to do. And it wasn't. It's, you know, the studios, you know, unless it's something that is a, you know, based on a, you know, best-selling novel or it's a, or, you know, another movie or a television show, you know, something that gives them the sense that this is a sure thing.
Can you just say it's a spinoff of The Following? we're doing a spinoff episode. Give us the budget of one episode and we can make a movie.
Well, that's the thing that happens when you're working on something about Poe. You start seeing, realizing that Poe is everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, every other day I'm doing a crossword puzzle, there's Poe in the crossword puzzle.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that not being something that the studios see as marketable.
I know. I mean, they did do that movie with John Cusack,
yep.
the Raven.
Yeah, but they made it an action film, and Poe kind of kicked ass in it, and that's not Poe.
No, you know, it had very little to do with the real Poe.
Yeah.
But
wasn't Stallone for the longest time working
that's right.
on? Yeah, he was.
And that was about that period, right, where he disappeared, and the lighthouse at the end of the world or something
yes.
like that?
And Michael Jackson wanted
right. I remember that.
To play Poe.
Wanted to play Poe for Stallone. There's a movie that should have been made in the pantheon.
I know.
But it does show the imagination that he captures on basically any filmmaker in this genre. You know, there's something in those stories that always catches your attention and you can never leave, right?
Well, there have been so many great movies. I mean, it was Roger Corman's movies that got me interested in Poe way back when.
Well, we were going to turn the discussion to favorite Poe films. So I want to know which are the ones, which of them also would influence like anything, any of the style of the sequences you'll shoot with the stories. Mine's a no-brainer because I've said it here before, but Mask of the Red Death, I think, is one of the finest films, period, especially visually, I've ever seen. I also think it's Vincent Price is like one of his finest kind of characters.
I would choose The Pit and the Pendulum, I think, as my favorite Corman movie.
Wow.
You liked it so much you made it.
I made it.
Yours is scary, though. Lance Henriksen is terrifying in that film. Like, I find him just, it's hard. Like, he's almost too much for me. Like,
yeah, he was almost too much for me.
Yeah.
He's a method actor.
Yeah.
He really became Torquemada on the set.
I remember seeing that film quite young, and, like, I almost couldn't take it because it just felt so intense.
Yeah.
You know, that character.
Yeah. Well, again, it was inspired by a trip to the Tower of London. Mm-hmm. Brian Usna and I were in London for the for a film festival there, and we went, you know, as tourists to the tower, and seeing the way that these people were, you know, kept in these tiny little cells and the torture devices and so forth. It was like, boy, the things that people really do are so much worse than anything you can dream up. And then it struck me that you could do The Pit and the Pendulum. You know, because it is set during the Spanish Inquisition, and it would be a great way to kind of redo it. You know, Corman, you know, his adaptation was fantastic, but you know, we took a little different approach with ours.
Oh, and you see the connection between that story and things like Saul, you know, it's just like it all just direct links, you know.
Yeah. Well, that was my dissertation. I talked about last week, how my dissertation. A large chunk of it was focused on Edgar Allan Poe, his torture stories that he wrote being channeled through Vincent Price, and those being the original torture films was us torturing Vincent Price through bright lights and smells and things like that.
Yeah. So.
That's good.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you got a good grade on that.
Not yet. Still in the works.
which is your favorite of the Price roles? Because I always think the Usher role is pretty amazing. Like, it's the least pricey. Like, there's something about his hair color. And
I don't know. See, I think creepy. That's the most pricey.
I don't think
that's
it,
the
no.
one where he's like, you know, everything affects him. He's so sensitive to everything.
But he has no mustache and no dark hair.
Everything
so he's like,
is about him wilting because of the sensitivity to everything.
The Tingler is the most pricey.
There's a great story about the making the Fall of the House of Usher. That was the first Corman Poe movie. And, you know, Corman really wanted to do it, but I think his partner, Samuel Z. Arkoff, kept saying, well, where's the monster in this movie? You know, there's no monster in this. And he said, the house is the monster.
Well, that's what Poe would have intended, because it's a gothic horror story, so the house always has to be the equal with the character, correct?
So what happened was, when they were doing the film, they actually have a scene in it, or a line in it, where Vincent Price has to go, the house is the monster.
that's great salesmanship.
And he didn't want to do it. He said, this is the worst line I've ever. I can't say this. This is terrible. And he said, no, you have to say it.
Oh, that's great.
Or else we won't get the financing to make this.
Oh, that's awesome.
All right, then I'll say it.
I always liked Tomb of Lygia. Uh-huh. That was always one of my faves. So.
That's an interesting one, yeah.
There were some other ones. You know, Ray Milland did Premature Burial, and I always thought that was a pretty great movie.
Yeah. That was the first non-Price one, right?
Yeah.
I have a list of Poe films that I want brought to screen. Rob, you haven't talked about your fave yet.
As I was saying before, I'm not as well-versed as you guys in Poe films. I mean, believe it or not, I'm not just saying this because Stuart's here, but I have fond memories of The Pit and the Pendulum, your version.
Oh, thanks.
Because that's the one. Elric and I are about the same age, so we probably saw it young, and I just remember being terrified of... Yeah, Lance was just,
Oh, yeah.
Also, I think compared to some of your other films, I think you always have such a playful sensibility in your horror, so they're always fun. You have a good time watching them. That film, to me, was the first one where it was like, no, it's like stripped bare, and you're not going to enjoy this, but you have to watch it, you know? Yeah. And that it was a lot more intense, I think. So probably why I didn't have the same reaction.
Although it was, you know, we did a lot of research on that one, and finding out about, you know, one of them was the sort of a day in the life of a torturer, you know.
Behind the scenes.
It was a schedule. It had this schedule. And it was like, there was something about it that was like, you know, 9 o'clock, you know, have coffee, 10 o'clock, hang the old lady on the wall.
You know, wow, that would be
you
great.
Know, 11 o'clock, lunch break. You know, it was like, and so we got into the idea that these people that are, you know, like the torturers, that this is what they do every day. And it's just a job for them, and so that became sort of horrifying and weirdly funny.
Right. Yeah, the routine of it. That's pretty. Yeah, I mean, there's been some interesting ones. A lot of the older stuff, the kind of more visual, the Gene Epstein, I think 28 House of the Usher, the French.
Oh, that one's totally trippy.
It's beautiful. I mean, I don't know if it gets the essence. And there's another one. I did the Spirits of the Dead thing by Fellini that has some interesting visuals.
Fellini's
but,
section is fabulous.
Yeah, there's a couple of them that. Which one had Fonda in it? Is it the Roger Vadim?
Yeah, Roger Vadim.
A couple of them kind of lost in translation for me. But the
Fellini one is that's such a trip. Toby Dammit.
So I also have to give a throw out to Jim Wynorski, who you would never think of doing Poe, but he did Haunting of Morella, which is now a really hard one to find. And I swear, if you cut out all the TNA and like big hair and
send it to us.
Half-naked witches, it's actually a really good Poe adaptation.
Really?
Yeah, I swear. It's not bad. Considering it's Wynorski, the set design.
Elric doesn't believe you.
The costume design. I have it. It's rather
Was
rare.
It him or one of his five aliases, which I found out he uses because he made so many movies every year. It wasn't because he was ashamed of them. It was because he would have to make five films a year, and the sales manager would go, you can't release five. We can't sell five movies. So he created aliases so he could sell all his movies.
That's a good problem.
Yeah, I thought that. Yeah, exactly, right?
No, and this was the one. It was scandalous because it had Nicole Eggert from Charles in Charge. She was in
Nicole Eggert from Baywatch in an Edgar Allan Poe film. I don't know.
Yeah, and she's half naked. In it, but they use body double for her because she didn't want to get naked, but everybody thinks she's naked. But it's also got Lana Turner, who was the one that Phil Spector killed, and it's like scandal surrounds this film, and it's got a lot of witches and body TNA lesbian makeout scenes. But if you cut all that out, it's actually a really good Poe adaptation. Actually, I'm pretty sure Poe probably would have liked all the body TNA lesbian makeout witch scenes. They probably would have enjoyed it. So, but yeah, it's not a bad film.
Did you ever see Two Evil Eyes by...
Yes.
Yeah. What did you think of that in terms of adaptation? Not so much as a film, but did you think they were kind of interesting?
Well, it was interesting because when I was going to do The Black Cat for Masters of Horror, they were concerned because Dario Argento was one of the masters, and that were afraid that this would offend him, that I was going to redo.
Even though there's nothing connecting those two, two visions.
That's what I said. I said, I don't think this is going to...
No. His was very contemporary. I mean...
There's nothing... The two are so different.
Yeah. It's interesting. I rewatched it not long ago. I thought it was interesting as a film. I don't know if it was as interesting as Poe adaptations. I thought that, you know, there's moments with the cat and Harvey Keitel that work, but it just, again, maybe like you said, it doesn't necessarily go all the way.
Yeah, they couldn't bring themselves to hurt the cat, which is really what the story is about.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems, and I mean, because so much of your work was Lovecraft inspired, when you were younger, did one of them have more of a pull? Or were you interested in both writers?
Well, I got to Lovecraft later. Uh-huh. You know, Poe sort of led me to Lovecraft. Hmm. But the two writers are so different. You know, the Lovecraft never has women characters in his stories, and Poe is all about women.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a romantic.
Right, and if you look at their lives, they couldn't be more different, right? Like, Poe, you kind of fall in love with the idea of this romantic, and then you start reading too much about Lovecraft, and you might get turned off because he might have sympathies you don't agree with, you know?
But although Lovecraft did find love, you know, late in life, you know, he was married, and there's a lot of stories about his wife, you know, sort of introducing him to sex.
Mm, interesting. Would he make an interesting, I mean, because I know he's a lot more sedate, a character, would he make an interesting like biography film, or would it just be too internal?
No, I think he'd be he's a fascinating guy.
His New York years when he had like his freak out, I think would be really fascinating to look at.
Well, that whole story about him getting married, you know, he was anti-Semitic and he ended up marrying a Jewish woman.
Yeah, it's
interesting. And she brought him to New York City, took him away from Providence, Rhode Island, where he'd spent his whole life, and opened him up to all sorts of things.
But that's when he wrote my three favorite stories. He wrote Murder in Red Hook, The Music of Eric Zahn, and Cool Air. And those are like three of my favorite of his. And they were all written under the duress and stress of living in Red Hook.
I think he also, I want to say he wrote Reanimator during that time as well, as a serial. You know, one of the weirdest Lovecraft stories he wrote then was Ghost wrote it for Harry Houdini, called Imprisoned with the Pharaohs, where it's about, you know, it's all written in the first person as if Houdini is telling the story.
Was it you or Dennis who discovered the Herbert West story, of Reanimator?
It was actually a girlfriend of my brother-in-law who you mentioned it to me, and I had never heard of it. And it was because the story was out of print for years and years. Lovecraft didn't like Herbert West Reanimator. Hmm. You know, I found out later the reason he didn't like it was that he'd been paid to write it.
It wasn't pure.
Yeah. You know, he was into this thing about being an amateur writer, and that amateur means doing something you love to do. And if you're being paid to do it, then it doesn't count.
Interesting. And for you, you went directly from theater to that, or was there something in between? Like, how did you make that leap to be like? It's interesting now that kind of you're going full circle by returning to theater.
Yeah, I started doing theater and actually did a play called Poe back in the early 70s. That was about his disappearance.
Mm. Oh, cool!
You know, it sort of focused on that and sort of went into Poe's mind, and you know, it was a sort of a phantasmagorical collage of his life and his stories.
And that'll be an extra feature on the DVD for anyone interested. That will be an extra $100,000 to shoot, but still.
it would be an expensive movie.
Yeah, I'd say so. But I mean, we were discussing before, like, obviously both of them have like cinematic qualities or things that light your imagination, but you know, we were discussing which one.
We were arguing about this.
Well, I don't even know if I have a good argument. I just, from the films I've seen of Lovecraft, I feel like, but they're also yours, so this isn't a great argument. But the ones I've seen, for me, they're more cinematic than a lot of the Poe adaptations, which always feel a little more dated to me, even though the ideas are amazing. And you think the opposite way.
I disagree completely. I think that Lovecraft does not lend himself to cinema because he's so vague with his descriptions. Everything's like a shapeless form.
But to me, vague is exactly what a filmmaker
unexplainable
wants.
Unexplainable music.
No, vague is great because you use your imagination.
Is descriptive.
So. Well, you have imagination, right?
A little bit.
All right, so then use that.
How much is left.
Use that.
I don't. When I read Poe, I picture what's going on. When I read Lovecraft, it's always like unexplainable, and he describes it as unexplainable.
Well, right.
Some of his stories are like that, but there are other stories of his that are very, you know, explicit and clear. And I think those are the ones that make the best movies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of, you have to sort of look for the sort of action-packed stories.
What was the story behind From Beyond? I don't know anything about the backstory of From Beyond in terms of the story it's based on. What was that about? How obviously it can't be that similar because it feels
well,
From Beyond's so
modern.
From
Beyond was one of Lovecraft's earliest stories.
Right.
And it was only 7 pages long.
I imagined it was slight.
And so we used up his story in the pre-credit sequence of the film. And so everything that came after that had to be kind of invented.
So it was about dimensionality.
Well, it was about a scientist. You know, the story is about a scientist who develops this machine that, you know, stimulates the pineal gland.
So that was part of his.
Yeah. That's in the story. And that... He brings his friend to show it to him, and the friend had thought he was crazy, and he said, "See, here's it really is true." And what he wanted was for the creatures from the beyond to eat his friend, kill his friend. That's sort of what he.
How interesting!
What the setup is, but he ends up getting killed by them himself. I've ruined the story. I should have said spoiler.
Has there been like renewed interest? Because I always think that film. I mean, I grew up in New Zealand. I saw that film. That film, again, was kind of like Society. They were like not films that were hard to find where I grew up. They were like as mainstream as Reanimated. They were on the same shelf. Whereas here I've noticed films like that went under the radar.
From Beyond was a little bit more under the radar, right. But all of like Reanimator was huge.
Right. No, of course. Yeah. But I mean, now that Scream Factory, there were our guests last week. Gorgeous transfer.
It's a beautiful film.
Do you find that people are more aware of it?
I think over the years, it's become, you know, its popularity has increased. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy I was able to restore it because the MPA really savaged that film.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And was able to put back everything that they cut out for the high-def version.
How much was cut out from there? Didn't know that.
I would say about 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And it was sort of the key 5 minutes.
The sexual stuff, or is it more gore stuff?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, you know, they sort of really defanged it as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think a big part of the appeal of that is because I remembered vaguely as a kid, but then for many years it was really hard to get, mm-hmm. especially like when DVDs first started coming out. And it was like and I remember this has to be at least 10 years ago when me and a friend met Ken Foray at a convention and asked him about it. And he was like, man, like, oh, when can we see the uncut version of From Beyond? He's like, man, I'll have one foot in the grave before that ever happens. And I was like, well, thankfully, you know, it was a lot sooner than that. But
I'd been looking, you know, cause people were asking me about that for years. Uh-huh. And I was looking for the footage and couldn't find it and had been told that it had been destroyed. And then I got a call. The movie ended up being sold from one company to another and ended up at MGM. Mm-hmm. And the people at MGM called me up and they said, you should come down here. We found something. We don't know what it is. And it was sort of like being called to the morgue to identify a relative. And there was this little film can, and inside of it were all the trims that the editor had been made to cut by the MPAA. And we were able to put them back into the movie, which was using all the sort of digital, you know, magic.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Yeah.
And actually, was it true that you didn't intend that to be the next movie at that point? You were trying to make Dagon for a long time.
Yeah, Dagon was supposed to be the film to follow Reanimator.
Wow.
But
and that took, what, that must be 20 years later, right?
Well, it took 15 years. Yeah, 15
that is,
years.
So. I talk about that one on the show all the
time. Yeah,
it's one of my favorite films. And actually, I used to teach at Hunter College before I moved to Los Angeles. And I taught horror film history, and I did one of my units on adaptations, and I had my kids read Shadow Over Innsmouth and Dagon, and then we would watch the Dagon movie. And I'd done it for a couple of years, and one day I'm sitting in my office, and there's this knock at my door, and this man is standing there, and he goes, one of your students gave me your syllabus, and I was wondering if you want me to talk when you show Dagon. And I was like, and you are? And he goes, oh, I work in the writing center. I'm Dennis Paoli. And I was like, holy crap, you work at Hunter? And so, yeah, from then on, he talked to my class for the rest of the time I was in Hunter every single time I showed it.
That's wonderful.
That is really fun. I also want to ask, like, about the reverse adaptations. So adapting Reanimator from a film that you hadn't directed since the original, you know, like there's a franchise, obviously, afterwards, returning to that. I mean, A, what sparked the interest? And you had the old team back, which is the amazing part and probably why it works. But like, how did A, that even come up as an idea? And B, what was that process like? How do we make this into theater?
Into a musical.
Yeah, and fun and something that people will. Because, I mean, her intern for Fangoria must have gone, like 50 times or something.
My intern Amanda Story.
She might have
there.
Seen it every time.
I think she was there every night.
It was amazing.
She knew the cast by first name basis afterwards.
Did she work on it or she just went?
No, she went. She's a man, and she was there every night. And for my birthday last year, she took me. So I was like, fine, my intern's taking me out for my birthday. And she got us tickets and everything. And she was there every single night.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, it had that same, it did have that cult appeal. I mean, it had that thing that gets on your skin. You want to keep singing and being part of.
Yeah.
But what made you think it could have that?
People were suggesting it should be a musical for for years, and I kept laughing. I thought that was the silliest idea.
Yeah, I wouldn't see
you
that.
You know, and then one day it just sort of struck me, why not? You know, you really could use, you know, the effects were all stage effects, practical effects. Why not do them live on stage?
And that is part of the real fun of it, because you're the first time you see it, you're genuinely kind of surprised when stuff starts flying.
Yeah.
And Graham Skipper does an excellent job covering the audience in the final intestine.
Yes, indeed, he does.
Well, I got to say, actually, the first time I saw that, I had a really special experience because I actually saw you guys do a live reading of it months before you actually put the show together. I can't remember. I think it was either Jackson Stewart or maybe it was Zane Grant, one of those guys that I went with to see this reading. And the reason it was special is because it was literally them on stage just reading it. There's no gore effects, no nothing yet. They're just kind of working through it. And I think the cast was primarily the same. I think there's a different Dr. Hill,
yes,
perhaps.
That's right.
But because you hear Reanimated the musical, you have no idea what you're expecting. So I walked in there and I'm like, I have no idea how they're going to make this into a musical. And then seeing you guys perform it, like everybody with their scripts in hands, was just amazing. And even Stuart on stage, I remember you in the background, you were the cat.
I did sound effects.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
So just watching Stuart on stage, you're like, meow, meow, just in the background. It was like kind of hysterical and very magical. But I thought that was amazing. And also, the interesting thing is how characters in movies that you associate with actors kind of take on a life of their own. Meaning, I can't not think of Jeffrey Combs when I think of Herbert West, in the same way I can't not think of Bruce Campbell with Ash.
Right.
But in the same way, when I saw Evil Dead the musical in New York, as soon as that actor, that one was Ryan Ward, as soon as he got on and performed it, all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, it's not Bruce Campbell anymore. That's an actual character that they created. It has a life of its own. And seeing Graham, you know, play Herbert West and be able to sing amazingly, you're just like, oh my God, like it's not just Jeffrey Combs. I mean, he created it, but now other people will probably end up playing it for God knows how long. Like it'll be one of those characters, which is kind of an amazing thing.
Well, it's one of those things. Now, when I watch the movie, I keep waiting for them to start singing.
Now, that's another question. Obviously, the extension is: could that be filmed like a movie, but as a musical? Could Rihanna be reimagined, I guess, as a musical?
Sure, I mean,
it'd be interesting. I mean, Jesse Merlin is the thing about it that, like, I walked out just like mind blown about how funny. I mean, he was funny. Like, he could have been on Saturday Night Live funny, in my opinion, in that role. Yeah. Like, it just really kind of shocked. And some of your gags, some of your like live shifts, the first head shift off you're just like, wow. Like, it's like magic. Yeah,
Jesse's brilliant.
Yeah, it's good. But could you imagine that? Do you think that's something?
I think I think it could be done. But I, you know, my feeling is it's so much fun to see it done live.
Yeah, that could be.
You know, that's. You know, people are all about 3D and, you know, these, you know, trying to make the experience more, you know, involving in theater. You know, it doesn't have to worry about that stuff. It's really happening right in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Did you take Reanimated the musical out of town the way that you did Nevermore?
Yeah, our New York staff raved about it, so it must have made it to New York.
Yeah, we took it to the New York Musical Theater Festival summer before last, and it was a huge success there. We really had fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took it to the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland, and we did it there for a month. That was great, too.
Oh, that's excellent.
Have you guys done a soundtrack of the actual music?
You know, we haven't done that yet. I would like to.
That'd be fun.
I wish we had.
My intern will buy it.
Yeah, I think that would have sold a lot if you did it again. Yeah. Is there a thought to get that same group back, more or less, and do another?
Yeah, I mean, I think our plan is to bring it back to New York. You know, their reception there was so terrific.
Mm. What's the difference between LA and New York when it comes to that kind of stuff? Is the live experience? LA just can't really. It's not used. We're used to movies here. Is that the problem?
No. There's a really great theater audience in LA, and we ran the show for 6 months here.
Yeah,
I mean, it was. You know, audiences were terrific. So, it's just sort of with theater, all roads lead to New York.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I bet Japan, it would be huge.
But, you know, the few times I saw it in LA, it's like one time I went and like Joe Dante was two seats over, and another time Angus Scrimm. You're not going to get that in New York.
Yeah.
No, so. we had some wonderful audiences.
I went to
people showing up, you know, wearing, you know, white lab coats so they could get blood all over them. And
it's like a Guar concert. Yeah. I like that.
I went to the first, I think it was the opening one. And beforehand, we're in a diner across the street. And I said to someone, I wonder where Brian Yesna is, because he hasn't been in America for so long at the time. And I said to someone, I wonder where, you know, I haven't heard of him or seen him for like 10 years or something. Somebody, oh, he's making films in, I don't know, Spain. Is it some country? And then I get in line for my ticket and he was the person standing in front of me. And it was, and I told him, I said, I was just, it was like I had summoned him onto the plane. But but it was, how did people like Barbara Crampton and Jeff react when they first saw it? Barbara, was it shocking?
Well, I think Jeffrey was pretty shocked.
Right.
Shocked in a good way, I hope.
Well, yeah, good and bad. I think, you know, was the idea of seeing somebody else playing that part, I think, was kind of a little unnerving for him.
Yeah.
But, you know, he liked it. Barbara came back, you know, 3 or 4 times to see it.
Oh, that's
several
great.
Times.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, because the girl, the actress isn't playing that close to, like, Barbara. Mm-hmm. And same with, I thought Jesse Merlin's kind of taking it on his own to play the doctor, but really... The Jeffrey Combs character is really Jeffrey Combs. You know what I mean? You're playing that type. And so I can imagine that being a little unnerving. Mm-hmm. But it's still fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we cut, I was talking with everyone off camera, off mic,
off audio,
about Poe Day, because I grew up in Virginia. And because of Poe's proximity to Virginia, he grew up in Richmond, went to the University of Virginia and everything, and then transmigrated up to Baltimore. We had Poe kind of shoved down our throats the entire way through. And actually, the region I live in is what he called the Ragged Mountains, which is, if you're in Richmond, you go west and slightly south. And that's it's at the Appalachian Mountains, for lack of a better way of describing it. But we had Poe Day in a lot of the different grades, definitely in all of the English classes I ever did, where we would read Poe and talk about Poe and do Poe arts and crafts and things like that. So when you guys say you're not familiar with Poe, it shocks the hell out of me.
I'm familiar. I'm much more familiar with Poe than I am Lovecraft, like where I grew up, but not in the way that you grew up with him. Because in New Zealand, we have a day for the Queen's birthday. It's embarrassing. So it's nowhere near as cool as Poe Day.
We have Poe Day. So,
But Lovecraft, definitely not. I mean, Lovecraft, would probably not even be whispered where growing up. I probably didn't even hear mm-hmm. about it until I saw Reanimator, to be honest, or something like that, you know, mm-hmm. or got into horror.
Yeah, I definitely didn't hear of Lovecraft until it was actually in high school. I used to listen to some Swedish metal band. I can't even remember their name, but they had a song about Cthulhu. Hmm. And I looked up Cthulhu, and thus I was introduced to Lovecraft.
But. I saw a book once, and I didn't read it, but it really struck my imagination for a film, which was... I don't know if you're familiar with it, where Lovecraft and Poe on a stormy day get stuck in the same hotel and they start exchanging stories and they spend the night together. And I don't know what else happened. I saw it on the shelf one and I should have bought it years ago. It looked really interesting. I should look it up and pass on. But it was just,
they're 100 years apart.
Yeah. I mean, no, I'm sure it's like a mythological. Yeah.
Lovecraft reported reading quite a bit of Poe, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was very influenced by Poe. And as a matter of fact, tried to copy his style initially. Poe, I mean, is the most popular American writer. You know, he really is.
If you go to...
In tattoos.
Well, who else, what other writer has got an NFL football team named after one of his characters?
Oh, the Ravens.
You know, I mean, it's like, Poe is everywhere.
We have multiple pubs in Richmond, Virginia named after him. There's the Ravens pub, and then there's all these different pubs. But and there's also Poe Convention in Virginia that we have, which is like a literary convention just for Poe. But my favorite thing is in Charlottesville at University of Virginia, where he went to college. Mm-hmm. He was there only for a few months because they kicked him out for supposedly, I always heard, gambling, but he lost money and things like that. But he lived in these dorms that are, it's not like a building. It's like this row housing and it faces right out to the campus. And now you have to be an Eccles scholar. Like, you have to be one of the top students to live in these dorms, but they have his old room encased in glass. And if you look inside, there's a raven, an old moth-eaten bird, because nobody can go in there, sitting on the fireplace. Mm. And then they've got like an old raggedy coat up, and they've got century, like 18th century furniture, the original furniture and everything. And you push this button and it like tells you the story of Poe at University of Virginia and this horrible impression of him. So, but yeah, it's still there to this day, even though the university kicked him out, they glorify him now.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, that was why he had to leave home too, because he had, you know, the amount of money that he lost, I'm trying to remember what it was, but it was something fairly huge amount of money. Even by today's standards, and back then it would be like, you know, $500,000 or something.
Wow!
Oh my God!
Gambling.
Did he ever write like more diaristic stuff? So like more like of actually, I know his letters obviously are.
Well, he wrote a lot of essays about things. You know, he wrote an essay about how to write a short story, which is one of his best things. But he also wrote scientific articles, and you know, some people say that he's the one that came up with the idea of. You know, the idea that stars are, you know, light years away from us and that we're seeing them, you know, they're actually millions of years old, that we're looking at these old images of these stars.
I always liked his hoax stuff because he did a couple of articles where he wrote as if he was, it was kind of like War of the Words with Orson Welles, where he would write as if he was a doctor and he had just used galvanization, which is electrocution, to bring somebody back to life. And then it would be published in these journals, but it would be written like a factual, like, delivery of what's going on, but it was a total hoax.
He also wrote the first detective stories. Mm-hmm. And they were, and actually... Conan Doyle admitted that he basically ripped off Poe to create Sherlock Holmes.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the characters that he wrote, you know, were exactly like Sherlock Holmes and Watson. Mm-hmm. And Poe actually did solve a murder himself, you know, using the techniques of...
That's what I'd hoped the Raven would be. I remember hearing that story. I think it might have been from Jeffrey, and I remember it lit my imagination. Oh wow, you can make a detective series set in that period. You
well,
know,
it was
with
funny.
The
I ran into the people who were making the Raven, and it was kind of odd. You know, I mentioned something about Poe writing the detective story, and they didn't realize that.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, you know, they have him teaming up with a detective, and it's like
he was the
detective.
Yeah,
one less character they needed.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Do you have a personal favorite Poe story? Because, you know, it seems like at bookstores, they always have these great, like, complete works of Poe, like, editions and stuff. So if somebody would go out and buy it and start reading Poe stuff, which story is your favorite? What do you think they should start with?
Well, there's a story I keep thinking about a lot lately, which is, it's called The Case of M. Valdemar, which is a very creepy story about a guy, an old man who's dying, and he gets this idea that if he is hypnotized at the point of death, that maybe they can keep him alive.
Huh.
And and it's written from the point of view of the hypnotist who's brought in to do this. And he goes through with it, and they hypnotize the guy, and he ends up being sort of locked in this kind of trance, and his body, it's such a creepy thing. The body is moaning and crying, but the lips aren't moving. You know, they just, it's just lying there. And he's seeing, he says, "Where are you?" And he says, I'm in darkness. You know, let me die. He's like pleading with him. And this goes on for months. And finally the guy breaks the spell.
Huh.
And the last line of it is, you know, it's one of those lines that you just always remember. That he ends up turning into liquid putrescence.
So yeah, we're going to turn our attention just quickly to the, you know, because the Kickstarter, I don't think it's just because to plug Kickstarters, but I think given that you are a director who's made like a lot of the people listening and a lot of people in this room's favorite genre films, it might surprise some people that you have to use Kickstarter. So I think what it's showing is what Becca was saying, which is this is a shift into a totally different space and just like small, like I've been running a small business, same kind of thing. If somebody likes something, they should support it. And, or if they want to support it, they'll keep it going. If you don't want to support that, you can't expect it to keep going. If you don't want to pay for an indie film by a director you love, then maybe it'll never happen, you know? And so I think in a way, this could be a good thing. It's like we get to own what we want most.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I'm always dicey about Kickstarter though. I mean, it works.
The model's cutthroat because if you don't get it,
and
that's a little scary.
It's so saturated right now with so many indie films that it's impossible to discern out what's good and bad. And then when I see something like this is where I'm going to put my money, just because, you know, it's guaranteed actors and
Well, yeah. And there's a – like if it's a new indie film that you haven't heard of anyone involved, it's a risk, and maybe it's a good film, maybe it's not. But, you know, you've now seen a great stage show. You've seen someone's film work. So you can trust the team in place.
This has a track record. Yeah. I'm going with this one.
But it still must be like a kind of a scary way to go for you.
Well, it's new.
Uncharted,
It's completely new for me. And in a way, I think it's good. You know, I'm one of these guys who's sort of a Luddite, you know, when it comes to new technology. And this sort of forced me into that world.
Yeah.
And I'm enjoying it, I have to say. You know, I started to, tweet.
Yeah. And Jeff did too, right?
Yeah,
for people, Jeffrey's
tweeting. I was like dreading it, and it turned out to be really fun. I'm enjoying it.
Well, it's like real interaction with people who care about your work and are interested.
Yeah, and also in just getting, following other people who you admire or you want to see what they're
It's a lot of ideas floating around. It's easy to find them, you know.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And, coming up with the incentives for this was easy because there's so much, as we were saying about Poe, we even got the Baltimore Ravens to give us an autographed football.
Yeah.
As one of our incentives.
I am looking at your incentives on my phone right now.
And
we
did go to the museum, the Poe Museum in Richmond, as a matter of fact.
The house that you can walk through?
And they gave us a lot of things, including a book called Poe in Richmond, I believe.
Because you guys performed there, right? Didn't you? You performed near?
We actually went to Baltimore,
right.
Performed at Poe's gravesite.
That's right, yeah, I remember. But
I would love to go to Richmond. That would be one of
the cities. I'll put you in touch. Yeah. You need some theaters there.
I would love it, yeah.
So, I guess if you get something like a football, the key is then to make sure like the NFL or somebody tweets it, who reaches a whole different audience, right?
Yeah, thing. It's, you realize that, Poe, and that's the thing about him, both him and Lovecraft, during their lives, they both died in abject poverty.
Yeah.
Very young. Poe had 5 people at his funeral when he
died.
Whoa. Wow.
And now, they're like gigantic. He's the most popular writer in America. And the same thing's happening with Lovecraft. There's all these games and movies and, merchandising. I mean, if Lovecraft were alive, he'd be a billionaire today.
Yeah.
So, there's something about these both of these men who have captured all of our imaginations. And we feel like we know them. We love them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen the video yet that him and Jeffrey put together for the Kickstarter, check that out. It's pretty fun. There's one point where you bring out the bronze statue of Poe and... Jeffrey's like, no, wait, that's mine. I want it. You're like, no. Got to get it out. He's like, you want it, you're going to donate.
Yeah, I just saw that. I want that.
It's pretty fun.
And I guess when you're choosing between this and Indiegogo, I mean, I think this is relevant to like independent filmmakers listening to this. It's like, I remember you lose a certain percentage, obviously, of the money. And when you're going for hundreds of thousands, or as some actors have been going for a couple million, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So if you lose a few percentage, suddenly you lost $100,000 or whatever it is. I know Indiegogo was maybe a little less percentage.
But Indiegogo's kind of got a funky setup that makes it a little bit more risky, because if a film is asking for $50,000 and you donate $50, they get that $50
whether they
actually make that film or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
With Kickstarter, you have to reach the goal in order to get the money, which is a little bit reassuring. For the investor, it's better.
But for the filmmaker, it's probably a little scarier.
Was there a debate between Kickstarter and Indiegogo, or did you do research and that sort of thing?
Yeah, we did. We talked about both of them, and we felt that Kickstarter was the way to do it.
Kind of an all or nothing, because that's the budget you need, and if we can't get it, we can't make the movie.
I think Indiegogo is something I'd like to explore in the future.
Yeah.
I think
it might be better for if you were trying to get $2,000 or something small. I think it might be a really good site for that.
Yeah, my first film was Indiegogo. Yeah. We were hoping to get $5,000. I think we got $3,000 and we still made
the
movie.
Yeah, and you can still make the movie.
Yeah.
That's great.
But I think in this situation, when you know what your budget has to be, it's probably all or nothing. I mean, I guess the scary scenario is if you get a huge amount, but don't, if you're on $300,000, and you need to get that other 75. Do you guys have to think about look other investors at the last minute just in case, or
is it all options? Yeah, I mean, you get into the sort of scramble mode at the end. I think
like KCRW when they do their pledge, and you're listening. It's like Will Ferrell will give $10,000 if somebody doubles.
But there's something about it that's inherently dramatic too.
Right.
We're almost there. We need your help to.
Maybe we need to do a live telethon for the last 24 hours and just stream it. We can do it at Jump Cut.
I love it. Let's do it at Jump Cut.
You'll have a heart attack at the end, though. But, but there must be. So before we wrap, let's. What are some of the other cool incentives? Like, I know there's obviously going to be some original posters from your films.
The posters are all gone. As a matter of fact, good. We had From Beyond and Reanimator posters.
I just saw some stuff from some of your other films, like King of the Ants.
Yeah, yeah. We just put up some soundtracks from King of the Ants and Reanimator and From Beyond. Which will be signed by the composers as well as myself and Jeffrey.
Here's a quick interjection because you mentioned that. Daniel Roebuck Lafour, Facebook, says, would you like to explore further the themes or story of King of the Ants in the future?
King of the Ants?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because we did talk about the idea of a possible sequel to that movie. Yeah.
He must have thought that. Before we came out, we asked a few questions, and I think
I've got a few.
You've got a few. I want to make sure.
But since you mentioned, and I'm glad you mentioned King of the Ants, because I actually wanted to do a quick roundtable with you guys. Hmm. Your favorite scene or most memorable moment from one of Stewart's films? Because the one I'm going to throw out.
Can I just say something?
Go ahead.
Get a job and a site. Done.
Well, actually, you know what I love is that Waxworks record that just came out of the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I love that side A is Cat Dead and side B is Details Later. When I pulled that record out, I thought it was amazing.
That's really cool. Yeah.
But no, what I wanted to say was, I mean, obviously I love Reanimator, I love From Beyond, I love those like kind of out of control, like horror type of movies. Mm. But I own King of the Ants. I've only watched it once. And the only reason is because I think it's to me one of the most horrific murders ever captured on film. When Ron Livingston gets killed by that lead character, it's so long and drawn out and upsetting that I never want to watch it again because I mean that as a compliment. It's one of the most hardest scenes and things to watch. So that's got to be probably the most memorable moment that I think. I've seen one of Stewart's.
There's a murder that's also pretty brutal in Edmund, right? I mean, is it the wife that's stabbing the wife? I'm trying to think.
It's not his wife. It's a girl he spent the night with.
Yeah, it's just kind of.
Why are you so good ugly at those types of scenes?
Yeah, yeah. Why are you so good at ugly?
Well, it's like Poe is a serial killer.
Yeah,
and I guess we all are inside.
Yeah,
at some point.
All right. Why don't we do a couple of quick questions and then we'll wrap up here. From Facebook, Jeff Dean wants to know, what are some of your fave genre picks of the last couple of years? Obviously we know some of the classics, but what have you seen recently that you think is kind of strong horror?
Well, the strongest thing I saw in a long time was this movie called A Serbian Film.
Wow. That is strong.
That movie knocked me out. I thought it was extremely well done.
And, so did I.
And very, very powerful and amazingly well made. And it was funny because I ran into the guys who made it at a film festival.
You got arrested?
Before I saw it.
you're in jail and you visited them in jail?
No. They came up to me and they said, Stewart, your movie inspired us to make this.
And wow.
Which one?
Yeah, wow.
Amazing Ice Cream Soup, probably.
I
think it was From Beyond.
Beyond is a very kinky movie. I mean,
yeah,
after
I saw their film, then I realized what they were talking about because it's about sexual horror and it's something that you very seldom see anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's actually funny. That's BJ's question. BJ's a friend of the show.
Seen when you see America? Like one thing we often talk about here is that maybe the imagination or the fantastic has been missing in horror the last, 20 years compared to maybe in the 80s. Maybe that's one of the essences of people like Coscarelli and people whose work had something you could really fall in love with. Have you seen any work like that in the last few years in America or anywhere that is a little bit more maybe, I don't know, magical might not be the best way, but fantastical?
Yeah, I mean, there's this Korean movie called The Host.
Phenomenal. They're making a sequel right now.
Yeah, good. I met the director in that one also. And he was very upset because I guess that J.J. Abrams was talking to him, and he thought that J.J. Abrams was going to give him some money to make another movie. And then J.J. Abrams went off and did Cloverfield.
Oh, Cloverfield. Yeah.
Which is shockingly similar.
Yeah.
But without the humor.
Yeah.
I mean, that thing about The Host you remember is the humor. You remember the conversations and the crying.
I'll tell you what I liked about The Host was that most movies about giant monsters are all about the National Guard and we've got to tell the president.
Right.
This movie was about a family. And they made it very personal, and I liked that a lot. And I also thought that the monster was just the greatest. You know, it was like, you think you've seen it all, and then you see this.
Yeah, he was really cool.
So I'm going to call you out on it while you're here. You didn't mention any American filmmakers in the last two things, Serbian films. So are there any, and if there's a problem with new American films, you can say it. We are on air. I'm just curious. Do you think there's something maybe changing in the culture, like genre in America, or is it just, are we kind of mining the well too much? You know, I feel like this has been a great year in horror. I've said a lot this year. This year, over the last few years, I've seen a lot of films that kind of have surprised me, a lot of indie stuff that's impressed me. But
well, you know, I think that there are, you know, I mean, there are good movies being made all over the world.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I like now. Is it used to be that, you know, horror was an American thing.
Right.
And now it's international. And
yeah,
it's always interesting to see different cultures, you know, what scares them, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of taken with those.
You're still avoiding that.
I actually would agree with kind of what you're poking there, Elric, because I think that American films now, what we've seen is a trend. In the 80s, it was all about us going into the fantastic.
Right.
We're entering the beyond. We're entering all of these fantastic realms. But now, often for budget reasons, it's all about that just trickling slightly into our world.
I will mention one movie, especially since we're talking about Jeffrey Combs, that I really liked a lot. It was called Would You Rather?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
I talked about it a few weeks ago, and I think it's his.
We had Daniel.
I think it's my favorite of his performances since The Reanimator. Honestly, I think it's a really good performance.
He's great in that film.
Yeah.
But the film itself is really great,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it was fun. I was really surprised.
And really well acted and builds a huge head of steam, I mean, in terms of creating suspense and dread. Mm-hmm. I like that movie a lot.
Yeah, it was a real surprise, that one. Because you expect just a kind of straight torture.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a torture film.
It's a lot more fun than that. It I don't know. There's a quality to it, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll take that. I'll take that one American director.
Well, that's a good one because it's an indie film. It wasn't done by a major studio.
Yeah.
It's definitely a quiet release. I like that.
I think it's always worth us like trying to figure out like what, like we said, are we just doing the films because they fit within our budgetary constraints, which to me is not, you know, not a great way to go about filming. You want to see the imagination unleashed a bit.
Well, I would ask you guys, what are the films that you would recommend?
Oh, God. You'll have to listen to the last 20 episodes of the show. Yeah. We've listed hundreds. Well, recently, there's been quite a few.
I talked about in my review of Prometheus that, love or hate the film, it was one of the first films where our world traveled to another world and entered into their realm in a long time. And so, love or hate the film, you got to love it for at least that, for pushing us into the fantastic instead of just having it leak into our world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen it. I mean, lately we've been talking about a couple smaller films, The Battery.
Oh, it's amazing.
A film called Resolution that we had on people. And both had, you know, imagination within the budgetary constraints. And I think what we were saying is like they knew exactly, if they had the clear vision of what they wanted to be, it didn't matter if they didn't have the budget because they found a way to shoot it. In a way that you didn't need to see 100 zombies. You knew they were there. And I think that's smart indie filmmaking, where sometimes it's kind of like they had the 100 zombies, they didn't have a clear vision. And so I don't know. But, you know, this year I've seen a lot of interest. Did you see a film called Citadel by any chance? Irish? It was interesting. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting one.
Stoker would definitely be one I would recommend, just because they had a budget. It was Chan Wook Park, but he used his budget to create amazing visuals, and it's all in the cinematography.
Film?
Stoker,
the guy who made Old Boy, his new film, director.
I did see that.
Yeah. It's very gorgeous. I mean, I don't know if it's a straight horror film, but yeah, it's a
beautiful
a thriller,
film.
Or it's kind of Hitchcockian, you know?
Yeah, very Hitchcockian. Mm-hmm. It's actually like Uncle Charlie.
Uncle Charlie, yeah.
What's the name of that movie?
We did this before, and it was the same title that got us all. It's actually embarrassing. We're going to have to cut this part out because this happened at the exact point of a show where somebody goes, oh, yeah, it's Hitchcock, and everyone like got on their phones.
Uncle Charlie, and then we were Googling it for an hour.
It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Whatever that is, is a great movie.
So I want to ask, is there any Poe or Lovecraft stories that you would really someday like to make to film that you have not yet?
Well, Dennis Paoli and I have been trying to get a movie made for 20 years of The Thing on the Doorstep, which is one of our favorite Lovecraft stories.
I want to see this movie.
Yeah, so do we.
Wow.
And there's already a script for that, right? I think, because I know you've been talking about it for a while.
Yeah. It's a great story. It's one of the few Lovecraft stories that's got a strong woman character.
Yeah, he didn't use a lot of women, it was always reported that he was severely xenophobic and multiple phobias of other things too. So.
Yeah.
Shadow of a doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt.
It was Shadow of a Doubt, guys.
Sorry, guys. It would drive me insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A great movie. Joseph Cotten.
Yeah, Joseph Cotten is. Yeah. Do we have any other questions? To
yeah, we,
I think
have,
we had a couple.
We had quite a couple, but I'm just going to kind of combine. I'll combine two of them. Dominic asks, why do you enjoy collaborating with Jeffrey Combs so much? And on the same token, Adam Barnick asked, what is your process like with actors directly, especially considering you come from theater and then have done, films as well?
I always like to rehearse, you know, before we shoot, you know, rehearse for at least a week or, you know, longer if we can. Mm-hmm.
Do you do your rehearsal as, all the way as characters, or is it more just discovery? Because, I mean, some people think of rehearsal, some people don't like to rehearse with them getting too familiar with the character or doing the character. They try to read it flat or...
No, I don't. I think you have to, I mean, an actor can really develop a character in rehearsal. And, people are always worried that rehearsal is going to make them lose their spontaneity, but, you know...
Yeah, you hear that a lot from people.
Those are people who don't do theater, I think.
Right.
Because when you're doing theater, you're doing it 8 times a week. And it has to be fresh every night. And
did you have that kind of rehearsal for the original Reanimator?
We did. Mm. We did. And all of the, the thing I like about Jeffrey Combs, to answer that part of your question, is that I love actors who are willing to make fools of themselves.
Mm. Yeah.
who are not afraid to try crazy things. And
you mean like George went dressed as a woman on stage, which was hugely impressive.
Yeah.
It's like... I think you actors who are ready to just take chances. Those are, and Jeffrey's one of them. And I never know what he's going to do next. He's always surprising me, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'll just do like one more. Jeremy on Facebook asks, kind of interesting. If you were given a choice, would you prefer a $20 million budget backed by a major studio or something smaller like $5 million from an indie studio that you would have final cut?
Well, it's nice having Final Cut, I'll say that. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to have a budget, too, And, so I would actually say, give me the $20 million.
You'll deal with whatever they throw at you.
Yeah.
Which of your films was most messed with by other hands?
It was actually From Beyond, which was, and it was the MPAA that really did a number on it. Yes, indeed.
Interesting. Is there a film of yours that you wish... more people, one that maybe hasn't been discovered as much that you kind of would like to know if people...
Well, it's funny. The one that no one can believe that I actually directed is The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit.
Which is an amazing film. My husband and I, we watched that. We were in college, like 1998. Is that when it came out?
Yeah.
And we watched it just because it looked fascinating. And it's such an amazing film.
Yeah, it's really fun. And it's, it's a Ray Bradbury story. Mm-hmm. And very sweet and gentle and colorful and crazy.
It's almost like a kid's film.
Yeah, it is.
But you were part of another kid's. You did the Honey, I Blew Up the Kids or Shrunk?
Well, I did both. I did both, actually.
As producer, right?
Brian Usen and I created Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And then I was the executive producer of the sequel.
I talk about society a lot on this air. because it just never really came out here properly. But, what was the relationship? Obviously, you and Brian had a really, fruitful relationship. What was the decision? Was it always known that if Reanimator hit, that he would go on to direct a sequel? Or was that just something that kind of naturally developed?
I think, Brian certainly wanted to direct.
Okay. Even when you first worked.
Yeah. And I wasn't really crazy about doing a sequel to Reanimator because I knew that they would not allow it to be released unrated, which the original film had been. That sort of ties your hands to begin with. But I thought Society was amazing.
It's a film that I think was really misunderstood, and hopefully will get rediscovered. I hope it gets kind of the treatment some of yours have recently.
Because I think it has. I think it's people are really it was interesting that there was a poll that was just done. I just read about it in the best 100 horror films.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was done it was Time Out in Chicago and Society came up. I think it was higher ranked than Reanimator was.
Oh wow!
So I think Society is getting its due.
I wouldn't quite agree with that in terms of quality, but in terms of like strange things that you'll never see. I mean, that's the cool thing about genre cinema is you can see things that you almost maybe couldn't even imagine occasionally. And Screaming Mad George achieved things that I think a lot of minds couldn't imagine, you know?
No, he's a surrealist for sure.
Yeah, it's really unique stuff.
But on the Lovecraft vein, I always liked using his Necronomicon too. The Book
of
the
Dead. I haven't seen it.
See, this is my thing about Usna films, is so few of them have actually been released out on DVD and Blu-ray. But Necronomicon, Book of the Dead, never made it out. But
you had planned on returning at one point. You guys had the kind of White House Reanimator story that a lot of people had heard about.
House of Reanimator.
We used to get that question over and over Fangoria. It was on the chats at least once a week. What's going on with the White House Reanimator?
Well, we're still thinking about it.
But that obviously was partly very timely to do with
Bush
presidency.
It was very much about the Bush years.
We're getting back there.
Well, we are.
We're on our way, guys.
We are. And things are getting so crazy now. It's like, I think it's...
Maybe. Well, as of the recording of this, we don't actually have a government, so if that helps. They're closed, but we're open.
Yeah.
So.
Sucks, because as of January, I don't have health care.
There you go.
You'll have health care. Yeah, you will.
I don't want to get into all political on here, but Aetna dropped all California residents as of January 1st because they said they couldn't compete with Obamacare.
Well, get Obamacare then.
Is it happening? I can't sign
up.
Sure,
it's happening. Yes, it's happening, and you can sign up.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've been trying. I'm going to keep trying.
But is that an itch that was also somewhat like satisfied by, you know, the return to Reanimator by the musical? Mm-hmm. Or do you really think there still could be another really fresh story with the...
Yeah, we have some ideas. I mean, we're kind of kicking around some ideas. So, yeah, I think you could do it.
Is Dennis still working at Hunter?
Yes.
I need to go back and give him a hug at some point.
Yeah, he would like that, I think.
He works in the writing center. So if you're a Hunter student, you can go get Dennis Paoli to help you write your papers.
Absolutely.
Pretty amazing.
Well, this month is key to getting the word out. So if anyone's listening to this today, we would appreciate you guys retweet about this particular, both this show and also about what he's trying to achieve. They've got a long way to go. And check out the video and make sure it's something you actually really want to put money in. Don't just do it because someone's asking you. Yeah. Trust us when we say that this. I mean, I remember when I saw the show, the only reason I wanted it filmed was because I thought, man, every school on earth
needs to see
this
it.
Would change their perception of his work.
Yeah, totally.
And any kid, any 16-year-old who popped that in would go, whoa. You know, who is, you know, this character just seems so fascinating. So I feel like if you can achieve even half of that, intensity and beauty, it will be great. So, help him out. Hopefully I imagine you'll be appearing all over the place at least a little bit this month. Just, you have to get this out there.
Absolutely.
So, and they're not asking for that much, $360,000?
$375,000.
Which, I mean, for a feature
For a feature is
a great price. It's a great price.
Yeah. So. And off audio, we'll ask you what that would actually, how you came to that, how you're going to deliver.
That's an amazing rate for a film. So that's awesome.
But so please help us support it. And let's hope that this can be a film. If you get the money, how soon would you be planning like principal photography?
We're looking at next summer.
Okay. Awesome.
Terrific. Where would you shoot at?
That's something we're thinking about. You know, we're looking at
tax incentives.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, this is...
Well, thank you for inviting me. This has been fun.
And I hope we're your first stop to come back when you get the money.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's the first scoop.
Exactly. All right. Well, everyone, thanks for listening. And you'll hear us next week with who?
I don't want to give away the guest names, but it will be our soundtrack episode.
Okay.
For sure. Soundtrack.
And it has some relation to this episode?
Two completely different soundtrack people. Does it? Is it?
Yeah, we have two soundtrack people coming in back to back, don't we?
No, I put together two completely different guests, soundtrack related.
Oh, are they coming in at the same time?
Yes.
That's going to be a hell of a show.
Is it one related to
these guys? I'm pretty psyched.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
All right. Mystery.
Tune in.
Cool. Like a post
that's
story.
That's how you do the mystery, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't even know what he's talking about.
Not in the middle of the show.
He just doesn't tell me who's coming until they show up. All right. Well, thanks so much, Stuart, for joining us.
Thank you.
See you next week.
We'll talk next week.